Cecina.
Welcome to Rock and Roll Tennis, the number one tennis podcast with your host, Keith Fraser. Yes, that's me. And my sidekick and former British number one, Mr. John Lloyd. So welcome to... Actually, this is the first recording of 2021. As always, I've got my main man, Flossie, the bronzed Adonis, John Lloyd, the man who is the, I would call him the rousing raconteur, such as the entertainment one can get from all the stories he's had in the tennis world and in his normal life. John, how you doing?
Doing well, thanks, Keith. Yeah, all good here. Played a little tennis this morning. I'm sorry that you guys are still in lockdown here, but I've got a lot of property I could sell you in Florida. I'm in the real estate business, so whenever you can get over on the plane, get over here, because we're doing pretty well over here, I must say.
Well, that's so I've heard. Listen, John, I have to say, I mean, you're looking good, and I've missed you, mate. Have you missed me? In the same,
yes.
We've got a bit of a bromance going on here. And listen, the podcast is going to go from strength to strength in 2021, as we hope everyone else is. We've got another great guest today, and he is a great guest. It's an absolute thrill to be able to welcome him. Former world number two, French Open finalist, lost to one of our previous guests, Gustavo Kuerten, 12 career titles. And now, of course, he runs his academy in Sweden. And of course, I have to mention his unbelievable success as a coach to Robin Söderling, who got to two French Open finals under his stewardship, I believe. And of course, Stan the man Wawrinka. He is Magnus Norman. Magnus, welcome.
What an unbelievable introduction. Wow, thank you very much.
Well, you deserve it. You deserve it. What an amazing tennis career you've had. I mean, you've had a great career, and you're still carrying on, going from strength to strength. And but you know, the interesting thing I want to say is, and I know it was hard for you because we asked the same of Robin. Your career finished early. I know that, and that was tough for you, wasn't it? Because I think you loved the game of tennis. How hard was it to swallow when you had to retire earlier than you'd hoped?
Well, obviously, really tough. I mean, you do what you love. The passion, my passion in life is sports. My you know, tennis in general. It was really, really tough. I mean, I was my ranking was number four in the world when I first had my injury to the hip. I continued to play for another 2 years. I really tried to make a couple of surgeries. You know, I went to rehab, but nothing really worked. I mean, so. Together with my doctor, I decided, you know, that it's better that I stop my professional career. I did, you know, try to find my life outside tennis. Was not easy, of course. I was a bit burned from you know, all the rehab and trying to come back, not being able to continue. So for two and a half years, I didn't touch a tennis racket. I didn't watch any tennis at all. I just went to get my you know, went to back to school, actually, studied marketing and economics, got myself a real proper job, you know, from 8 to 5, went to the office every day. But then, you know, after a couple of years, I started to miss the sports again, the excitement, the preparation before a big game. Either you win or you lose, you know, there's a lot of emotions, I'm sure you, John, can, you know, it's tough to find that in a normal life, so to speak, you know. So it was a couple of tough years, but I'm happy that I got back to sports again.
You know, John's talked about it a lot, haven't you, John, about the fact that when you're a tennis pro, you never really prepare, if you like, for the afterlife. And I guess the afterlife came a bit soon for Magnus, John. I mean, that's hard when your career finishes early, right?
It's very difficult because you always want to finish whichever sport you're in as a professional. You want to finish it on your terms. You get that situation now where you get someone like a Roger Federer once saying he should have quit maybe a year or two ago. You know, you don't want to start losing to people and all that. But Roger's doing it on his own terms. When you, someone like Magnus, you know, that had no choice, that's difficult because, it's something you've been doing all your life and it's been your passion, and to sort of find that high like you have when you play a professional tennis a match or in any sport is very difficult. And when you're thrown into it earlier than your time, so to speak, it must have been a tough couple of years, Magnus, and you did well there going back to school and you know, getting your degree and all that stuff, because at least you found something, and then obviously you went from there to coaching. But I don't know if you agree, Magnus, I don't think at the ATP and in tennis in general, we do enough to educate the players about the life after the game. I mean, it's okay, perhaps, if you're one of the top guys, you know, you're wealthy beyond your means, all that. Even then, replacing what we have had is not easy. And I don't think they prepare players enough for the afterlife, the after tennis life. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, no, for sure. It's very difficult, you know, when the career is over. But at the same time, you know, yeah, of course, I know that ATP and WTA, they are really trying to do something. You know, they're putting new programs together, new initiatives with the different universities, you know, so the players can actually also study during their career. And we have some talks, you know, among the ATP coaches group, you know, talking about the pension plans and life after coaching as well. It's not easy, but then I think it's also up to every individual to trying to educate yourself. It's up to the, you know, to the parents. It's you know, what kind of childhood you have. It's at least when I coach younger players, I try to really put a lot of focus on, you know, that okay, tennis is of course important, but tennis is not the whole life. You know, there is other things as well. You know, you got to be able to read the newspaper, watch the news, educate yourself a little bit as well, because I think life becomes a little bit more if you only play tennis all the time. So I try to educate my younger players as well. I can ask simple questions about COVID, about you know, change of guards in the US. Do you know the name of the US president? You know, so it's, you know, it's not only about tennis. You know, you try to educate people for life. So it's
no question about it.
Well, the US president question, I don't even think they could have answered that in America a few weeks ago, you know, Magnus. So, listen, good luck if your boys and girls were able to do it. But I know you've got your academy, and obviously want to come back to your tennis career, but you've got a great name for your academy. I don't know if you know, John, it's the Good to Great Tennis Academy. I think it's a great name.
Yeah.
And I know from your coaching ability, Magnus, the way that you instill that kind of hard work ethic. I've heard you say that the biggest thing in talent is the talent to work hard. I guess that's what you instill into those players. Is that right?
Yeah. No. Well, I guess all the coaches at the academy is trying to you know, put a lot of focus on that. You know, we try to educate the players to take a lot of own responsibility for their career, because we try to focus on the age between, let's say, 8, 9, 10 years old to maybe 20, 21, 22, but then they should be able to fly a little bit alone. And if we as coaches are there like all the time, preparing the towel, preparing the grip or whatever it is, you know, preparing the water before the practice or whatever, I think we doesn't do them a favor. So it's very important to educate self-coach players. So at the end of the day, we as coaches, our job should be more in the early stages, 8, 9, 10, 12, 13, 14 maybe, but less and less when the career goes on. And yeah, of course, I 100% stand behind that. I mean, I think the biggest talent that I've seen over the last couple of years when I've been coaching is the ability to practice hard and to do it not 1 week or not 10 days or not every second week, but to do it like every day, 365 days of the year for many, many years. To be an athlete, even if you have a day off, you know, you're still a tennis professional. So that's very important to put a lot of a lot of talks and a lot of education about that. You know, it's a lot of hard work and you know, you got to lose a lot of matches, but it's important not to lose motivation. You know, so if you lose a match, you know, you still got to be able to go out in the afternoon or in the evening to practice a little bit more, or the day after, you know. So all the best players that I've been following a little bit that I see is coming up now from the juniors as well, they have this talent to never lose motivation, to work harder, to not to not have one bad week, you know, where they go out or, you know, they do shit, you know, they need to stay focused all the time and they need to enjoy it as well.
Max, with coaching, I'm always fascinated when someone like yourself who has coached, I mean, obviously some great players, and particularly obviously Stan Van Vrieken, who won three slams with you. When you started with Stan and Robin, but Stan even more so because obviously one said, what did you feel that was the missing ingredient in his game? Because he was obviously a good player when you got hold of him, but he wasn't a great player. What did you feel when you took him on? What did you feel that you needed to do to get into that next step? I mean, it's not just hard work, is it? Or is it?
No, it's hard work for sure. You got to prepare the player for big tournaments, so you need to put the plan in place. But yeah, obviously he had already a great team around him with sharing the fitness coach with the Roger Federer, Pierre Pagnini is his name, and he's been maybe the main guy in our team. And then also, you know, he has other persons around him that I felt was great. So very lucky to be able to work in a team where we always thought about the sport first. You know, we always thought about long-term development, you know, think long-term. We never, during our 8 years together, we never like changed the schedule. We only did it one time, and that was the year when he lost first round in French Open to Garcia Lopez. Then we actually put another week in the schedule for the grass. He applied for a wildcard in Queens actually that year. But other than that, you know, we stuck to the plan all the time. We were thinking long term, and I think the main thing that was the key that sort of made him go from good to great, so to speak, that he was able to win those matches where he normally played very well, but in the end he lost them. So I would like to rephrase that. I saw an interview with him during when we were working together, and he got the same question, you know, what did Magnus help you with? And Stan's answer was that, you know, he made me a winner. So I would, you know, I want to use his words, you know, and I think that's a lot of hard work, of course, but also talking about how he should play important parts in the match during five sets. You know, you're going to have a lot of ups and downs. Stan will always be a player that is playing with big margins. Of course, you know, he likes to play, you know, winners from basically everywhere, you know. And but we talked a lot about maybe using his fitness a little bit, because during the years when we were working together, he became very, very strong. So I told him, you know, that you have to rely a little bit more on your fitness, not all the time that you have to make the point. You know, you have to make a winner or you make a mistake. You know, you can put the ball over the net and inside the lines a little bit and use your fitness, especially first week of a Grand Slam. You know, we know that Stan is a little bit vulnerable in the first couple of rounds, but once he gets going, you know, he finds his sort of rhythm, he finds his range, then he's quite tough to beat. So especially in the first couple of rounds in Grand Slam tournaments, it was important for him to stay, to play simple, to play in the middle of the court, use his heavy shots, but not go for everything. So, long answer, but I would like to use Stan's word, you know, that maybe together it was the right moment in his career that he started to not only play good, but to also to win those big matches, you know.
Yeah, fascinating.
I was wondering, and I don't know what you think, John, but when you took him on, Magnus, did you think to yourself, we're going to win slams?
Yeah, good question.
No, I never thought that, and I never thought about it, and I don't think Stan thought about it either. You know, we always said that we want to try to prepare as good as possible so we can put ourselves in a good position to be there second week, you know, and then you never know what's going to happen. But also winning the first Grand Slam in Australia, after that, we also never spoke about winning the second one. We never spoke about that. You have to be so humble in the world of tennis, because there's always the next tournament, there's always the next week, there's always, you know. So, you know, we never spoke about that. We know that, you know, the competition is so strong. So if you have a bad day, you know, you can be out first, second round in a Grand Slam tournament if you're not 100% there. So the main goal was always long term. The main goal was always to try to prepare as good as possible and put yourself in a position where you can sort of challenge the top guys.
But when he won his first one at the Australian Open, I mean, I know obviously you have to be confident and you're with your player and. But the night before, I'm always fascinated about the preparation, even as close as the night before, because to me, that can be where you win or lose a slam. I know the preparation has gone in before, but if there's something psychological, something that can tip the balance, the night before, the talk you have and in the morning is crucial. Did you feel deep down that he was going to win his first slam there? I know you have to feel that, but did you... in your own instinct, you know, do you know what I mean? That you actually felt like he was going to produce the type of play that he did.
I didn't in Australia, to be honest. I felt like I could only relate to the feeling that I had, and also Robin when he was playing his Grand Slam finals, and
right.
We neither of me or Robin performed our best in our first Grand Slam final. So it's always a little bit different, you know. It's a big match, and all the focus are on you. So I didn't actually expect him to win against Nadal, and I didn't expect him to play as good as he did, and I didn't expect him to be so relaxed before the match like he was. He has something that I didn't have, certainly as a player. He has this the ability to step up in the big matches, and he's shown that during the years when we were working together. I had another feeling in French Open actually, and also in US Open when he won, because he was playing some amazing tennis, and in French Open he you know, he was playing good the whole 2 weeks, and we were a little bit lucky in the semis to have a pretty decent match. We finished our match on Friday, while Novak had to play again on Saturday. So I had a good feeling going into the final that he was going to perform well. And it's the same in US Open, actually. I felt like he was probably, you know, he was super, super strong, super fit, super like... in some really, really good tennis. So I had a good feeling going into that match as well. But it's important to find the right words before the night before, the morning before, or actually just before you enter the court. You know, I think it's important to, as I said in the beginning here earlier, that you know, life is more than winning a Grand Slam. So even if you have to downplay the situation a little bit, you have to put it in perspective. How to happens, you know, if you lose the match, if you lose the Grand Slam final, the life will still go on Monday, and you will have your best ranking, whatever, you know. So
it's very difficult, because you have to sort of bluff it, because you're basically as nervous as the person that you're working with, but you don't want to show that person that you are. But you are. I mean, that's just the facts. And you have to try and, you have to become an actor, I think. I did anyway, when I was coaching my ex-wife and so on. You have to basically pretend that, it's everything's going to be okay and all that stuff. It's not that easy.
No. Yeah. No. And also before the game, but also during the game, you know, that you... A lot of people they ask me, how can you be so cool during the match? And I'm nothing. I'm nowhere near cool. I'm just trying to be a good actor. You know, I'm nervous. But if I show a lot of emotion, and if the player feel that I'm nervous or whatever, you know, I think it feeds off of the player. So it's better to stay a little bit calm in the moment.
Yeah.
Although I remember, I correct me if I'm wrong, Magnus, that Stan said, I heard him interviewed, he said that before the Djokovic final, I think did he say he was sick, or he felt like he could be sick in the change room? He was that nervous.
Yeah, that was the final in US, yes. We spoke a little bit before the game in the locker room, and I told him how proud he should be of himself, not only for the way he did the 3 weeks in New York, but also for the couple of months leading up to the hard court swing. You know, we sat down in the hard court in the preseason before the US swing, and you know, we put some goals there, and he did everything we talked about. He did it like to perfection during that hardcore season. And I just told him how proud I was, and he was obviously very nervous. So he started to cry, and I started to cry when I saw him crying. And then we are like in the locker room just before the, you know, the referee is actually literally calling the match, you know, and we are both like crying. But it was like a good moment. It was like a lot of tension just released, and yeah, it was a great moment in our, you know, relationship.
That's amazing. That probably helped his performance, I imagine. Yeah. You know, that sort of outpouring of emotion, it probably settled him.
For sure. No, it was me too. I was super nervous, and I was proud, and he was nervous. And yeah, I was like, all the tension, like, I felt like it disappeared a little bit. You know, it was a good hug, and then he went out on the stadium court.
Fantastic.
Well, I've got to say that I know that John's up. We asked Tim Henman a few weeks ago, but same question goes to you, Magnus. You used to hit a double-handed backhand, and obviously Stan, you took him to three slams with a single hander. What do you teach your kids at your academy?
Well, it's basically 90%, 95% of all the players play with two hands when they are younger. So I actually never switch anyone from two to one. But I'm a little bit thinking about one guy now at the academy to switch him to one hand, actually. But it's, really? Yeah, it's difficult with the young players because they are not so strong. But there was a lot of talks a couple of years ago if the one hander is, you know, is disappearing. But I don't think so. You see Tsitsipas coming up, and you see a lot of young kids as well playing with one hand. So there is obviously a lot of benefits playing with one hand, and also with two hands. So I think it's 50-50 for me.
And Magnus, in growing up in Sweden, I mean, you had obviously three amazing champions. I mean, you had a lot more than that, but the three that come to mind for me, obviously, was the great Bjorn Borg and Mats Wilander and Stefan Edberg were the three that obviously there was a big boom in Sweden. Did Bjorn, were they the players that inspired you to sort of start when you were young, or with Bjorn? I mean, it must have accelerated the tennis side in Sweden big time when he started being so successful.
Yeah, it was amazing. I think it didn't really, you know, inspire me maybe, but my parents, so they bought a tennis racket. So for sure, those are the three number ones that Sweden had, you know. Then we had a couple of other fantastic champions as well, but those three are number ones. They are legends. Mats got a reward, you know, a couple of days ago, like the among all the sports in Sweden, so they are legends, of course. And one big reason why I, you know, started playing tennis was because of those three players. And growing up, Stefan was always my idol. You know, the way he was acting on court and the way he was playing. I know that I used to drive to see him playing in Stockholm Open a couple of hours. You know, so yeah, they inspired Sweden a lot, and they also, on the other hand, made it a little bit difficult for our generation when we started winning, because you know, we had great careers, but we never went to number one. We made Grand Slam finals, but we didn't win it, and we were compared to Mats and Björn and Stefan, which was obviously not easy. But now I feel like Sweden is it's a country of tradition. It's a country of, you know, the culture of tennis in Sweden is quite big. So I feel like in media, you know, when you talk to people, Sweden is really thirsty again for a good tennis player. So we have a, you know, big hopes on Michael Ymer and his brother Elias Ymer. We have one young girl who is top 100 again. So I feel like again Sweden is starting to, be really thirsty for a good player again.
Mm. You know, there's one guy, by the way, the Swedish guy. I don't know what happened to him, but I always thought that he had a really big game, and that's Joakim Johansson. I think you called him Pimpin. What was the story with him? I think he got to number 7 in the world, big serve, big guy. Didn't you think that he, again, another player who retired early in Sweden, did you think that he was one of the guys who potentially could have won that game?
Oh, yeah, for sure. He played some amazing tennis. I remember one time when he outserved, he could serve like, you know, millions of aces, and he was tall and he was quite athletic for being that tall. Yeah, but then he got injured. I think his shoulder a little bit hurt him because of his serve and everything. So yeah, we've been a little bit unlucky with myself, with Robin having to finish his career quite early, with Pim Pim as well. You know, so you know they could have, you know, potentially still be playing tennis. You know, and then Sweden would have had maybe two in the top 20. You know, with the Ymer brothers again coming in. So we've been a little bit unlucky, I have to say, as well.
Who are the players to watch out for now in Sweden? I know you said Mikael Ymer, he's 22, which I guess if you'd have asked 10 years ago, you'd have thought, well, he's got to make a breakthrough. But in this day and age, where you've got Federer, who's 39, who's still in the top 3-4 in the world, and Nadal, 34, who's just won his 20th Grand Slam, I guess age is not such a factor anymore, is it? And I guess he would be one of the up-and-coming players.
I think so. I think so, for sure. He has great hands. He's got great skills, very good eye for the game. He reads the game well. So he needs to put a little bit more muscle in his game, I think. Then it can be really dangerous. Then again, we had a couple of guys, you know, playing junior Grand Slams the last 2-3 years. And I think that's a little bit of a measurement, how Swedish tennis is going. We didn't have, you know, juniors in junior Grand Slam for a couple of years, but now we had it for 3 years in a row, which is a good sign, at least, you know. So we'll see. But it's a long journey. It's, you know, a lot of things can happen throughout the years, and you know, from juniors to professional tennis is never easy, like we all know. So it's you have to stay humble. You have to work hard, not one day, not 2 days, not 1 week, but you know, all the time. And then have good people around you that supports you.
Yeah.
John, what do you think makes a great coach? I mean, Magnus was obviously a great player, and he is obviously a fantastic coach. I mean, look at your record. I mean, you know some great coaches. Unfortunately, you know, your coach, Bob Brett, unfortunately passed away recently. But looking back over the last 20, 30 years, who would you say are, as well as Magnus, are the great coaches? And what makes them great?
Well, there have been so many great coaches. I mean, obviously, you know, it helps when you're familiar within yourself. I mean, I was with Bob Brett. I thought was a great coach. I was coached when I was very young by the great Lou Ho, who I thought was amazing. But, I, you know, I'm a big fan of Robert Lansdorp in L.A. What makes a great coach? Well, there's many things. I mean, there's obviously the understanding of the game, the tactical sense, being able to talk to your student or your player and really talk to them, that they listen, that they feel the respect for you, and that you know what you're talking about. And what Magnus said before, like the day before, you know, when he was with Stan, those critical moments, you know, because it, you know, I've always been a believer that if you walk down to a park and you watch, you know, 10 players play, and you put the, you know, the number one down to 100, and you space them out, and you put masks over their or bags over their heads, you couldn't see their faces, their strokes are very similar. They would be playing in a park, and you wouldn't always be able to tell the difference. But it's what happens in those crucial moments, and when you have a good coach, you know, they can make a player that's 80 to be much better than that by the things they say and the things that they know about the game. I'm not saying they can make them champions necessarily, but good coaches are, there's a lot out there that, in my opinion, you know, are just are sort of bluffing their way through it. But someone like Magnus, who's got the results and has done it consistently, they're the ones really, really matter. But it's all about knowing their players, knowing the characters. Tactically, you've got to be very, very sound and reading the game and just being able to get through to your players and have that respect from them. It's a very difficult profession, particularly these days. The loyalty factor amongst a lot of players is not that great. If the results aren't good within 3-4 months, you know, you get the push very quick, and you can sell someone like Magnus, who was with his players for a long time. That means he's a quality coach, because players stick with him no matter what. Not that he's had any bad results anyway.
Actually, I wanted to ask you, Magnus. Obviously, you're not going to, you know, I would presume you're not going to start talking about yourself and how wonderful you are, although you can, you deserve to, you've earned the right to do so. But you now hear this, it's almost like in football, you hear people saying the super agent, the super this. And we now have this terminology. Obviously, I don't want to get people to say anything slanderous, but we have this terminology that they use on Eurosport, the super coach. I know we had it when Agassi won his first Wimbledon, Nick Bollettieri, no previous experience playing at a top level. And we've now got it, obviously, with I've forgotten his name now. I think you know who I mean. John, help me out here.
Coaching who?
The Frenchman. Sorry?
Oh, Serena's coach.
Serena's coach, exactly. Yeah, I forget his name. But they're calling him the super coach. Do you have to be able to play at a top level to be a great coach?
No, absolutely not. Definitely not. I mean, a lot of the coaches that I respect a lot has never been, you know, top players. Obviously, they know the game of tennis, like John said. You know, they know the tactics and they know the feelings that the player feel when they walk on the court. So they sort of played until some sort of level. But not necessarily not on the ATP or WTA tour. And then you also have to. There's different coaches that are good at different things. You know, there's coaches that are probably very good in the developing ages. You know, between 12 and 16, 17, 18. And then there's coaches like myself that has been fortunate enough to work with really, you know, top players. So maybe I'm good at that level. That doesn't mean that I'm good with working with kids, you know. So it's I think you have good coaches in different ages as well.
Great. Yeah.
But yeah, it's a tough work for sure, and the loyalty factor, as John mentioned, is not there. So, but I've always been a believer in long term. You know, I never try to look for short term results or ranking too much. You know, if you do the work correctly and you have a process for it, I think the results will come. And also you got to build the trust with the player. And how you do that? Well, in my opinion, is to be really there when the player is having poor results, you know, that you really show your face and you really show your commitment to the player when he or she is going through a tough time. Because when the player is doing well, it's so many other people around the player that, you know, is there. So then I almost back off a little bit. But I always try to be there more when the player is going through a difficult time in a private life or in on the court or off the court. Doesn't really matter. But that's, I think, how you build a relationship with the player. And the player feels like you really care for him, you know.
Yeah, I agree.
I imagine, John, I don't know what you think, John, but I would imagine, a year or so ago, as you know, I had the opportunity of doing an event with one of the world's great coaches in another sport, Arsene Wenger. I don't know if you're a football fan, Magnus, but I'm sure you've probably heard of Arsene Wenger, yeah? And he said that it was about having a plan and being able to convince those people to enforce that plan. I guess you need to have the confidence that your plan is the correct one. And I guess in a way it's about communication. Mm. Coaching, am I right, John? Am I right, Magnus? Is about being able to communicate.
Of course. No, of course. In the beginning when I started working as a tennis coach, you know, I started traveling with Thomas Johansson for a couple of months before he retired. And then I started working with Robin. I think one of the toughest things doing the transition from player to coach was the communication, because obviously as a player you have so many things in your head and there were so many things that I wanted to say to the player, but you know you have to be able to sort out the most important things and you have to be able to know when to say things and when to be tough and when to maybe be a little bit more quiet, when to step in and be really forceful and when to not take a step back. So that was tough in the beginning because I wanted to say so many things, but in the end, you know, I think I said I communicated too much. So that's something that I learned over the years to be a little bit more selective and to know when to push a little bit more and when to step back.
Yeah, the problem, with the coaching is we just touched on it briefly. It's being able to get enough time, and as you said, Keith, it's planning, but unfortunately, in today's world, you have to be very careful in the people that you pick, because if they don't have that vision, the same vision as you, if results aren't so quick these days, you've got agents and you've got parents, you can be out of a job in 3 months and you've barely started. I mean, to me, it's almost like there should be a minimum of 6 months minimum before you can really look at the results and say, okay, is this person improving or not? I mean, you know, 3 months is nothing. It's absolutely nothing. And unfortunately, tennis is such a high revolving door with coaches that are coming in and out because people just don't have the patience. And it's that's a great pity because the good coaches or the great coaches, they have time and their players have given them time. Success doesn't always come that quickly. It really doesn't. It's a difficult sport that we're playing and there's a lot of competition and I wish players would just, and their people around them would just have a little bit more patience.
Incidentally, Magnus, who's next for you? I mean, I know that you've got your academy, but is there any, I mean, who would you love to coach? That would be a question I'd love to hear. If there was one player in the world today, you think, you know what? I'd love to take that guy's game by the scruff of the neck and make him into a Grand Slam champion. I thought of something.
Yeah, I have two.
What do you think? Is there one person
I
out
have
there?
Two.
John knows who I mean.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of both on the men's side and on the female side that I think has fantastic potential. But right now, I'm not looking to, you know, traveling for some time. I try to stay a little bit more at the academy. So, but yeah, obviously, I think down the road again in maybe a few years, I think I will miss the tour and I will miss the excitement of the game and maybe be ready to coach traveling again. But obviously, yes, both on the men's side and on the women's side, there's a lot of talent out there for sure.
Yeah, I know you're.
Who would you like to see him coach?
The one I throw to mind would be an interesting temperament, but I think with Nick Kyrgios I'd love to see Magnus try and get a hold of Nick Kyrgios. That's what I'd like. The trouble is with Nick Kyrgios, he doesn't want to be coached by anybody. That's the problem. But I'd love a chance to work with someone like that because that talent doesn't come around too often, you know. And he's just missing, he's missing the most important ingredient of all. The work ethic and I don't think he really wants to be a champion. I don't think he wants what goes with it, unfortunately. But I would love to work with him. I don't know about you, Magnus. I mean, as a sort of a fantasy kind of thing.
Yeah, no, I follow his career for a couple of years now, and know his Dan and him had a lot of tough battles over the last couple of years, and it's always very tricky to coach against him because he's so talented and I mean you never know which mood he will be in and he's good from both wings. He's got an unbelievable serve. It's very, very tough to read his serve and he's definitely one of the guys that can win Grand Slams and go very far in his career, and he's come very far. He's a very, very good player and I'm sure he's going to win Grand Slams in the future.
I know him and Stan Wawrinka had a bit of an issue, but if Nick Kyrgios gave you the phone call and said, all right, listen, in 2 years' time, spend time in Sweden for a moment. When you want to fancy getting back on the tour, will you come and coach me? Would you do it, mate?
You never know what's going to happen in the future, but right now I'm happy in Sweden, but I think I will coach again on the tour, if it's the men's side or the women's side, I'm not sure, but for sure, I love the work, I love the excitement before the games, and I love the challenge to take a guy like Nick, for example, that has clearly something to work on, that's a great challenge, I mean, no question about it.
Magnus, I mean, we've done, Keith, as we've done with a lot of our guests, and it's always fascinating me. I'd love, Magnus, you to have a chance just to pull together. We've done this with Tim Henman and a lot of the other players we've had on, ex-players and coaches, that to put together your perfect player from the era that you've been involved with now and past eras that you've admired. Just fire off forehands, backhands, volleys, serve, temperament, speed, just five or six of them. I'd love to hear what you think of that. I know you've coached a couple, so you've got to be careful in case they listen, I'd love to hear what your thoughts are on that. Serve, for me, what, how about the best serve that you've seen? Not necessarily played against, but that you've seen.
Yeah, starting from top down and starting with serve, I think... I think I'll go with Karlovic then, Ivo Karlovic, just to serve. Then he's got a lot of things in around him that's not as good. But just looking at the serve, I think it's probably the top guy, I'd have to say. And I think Ivan Isevich is close. Goran is close there, but I would say Karlovic probably. Forehand, I would go with. Probably go with Rafa, actually. I think his forehand is, you can hear the sound of the impact of the ball when he's practicing. I can walk past the court. I can walk, not knowing who's on court, but just hearing the sound of his forehand, I can hear that, okay, this is Rafa. I think he has unbelievable forehand. Doesn't matter which surface you play, that's probably the go-to when it comes to the forehand. The backhand, I have to say, when he's on, when he's peak, I would say Stan, because he can hit winners of his backhand. He can use the slice. He has a lot of variety on his backhand. I would say, every day of the week would take his backhand. His short cross court, opening up court, and then going down the line. Mm-hmm. When it comes to quickness on the court, I would say Novak probably. The way he's moving and how athletic, how flexible he is now, how light he is on the feet, and I would say Novak. So speed on the court, Novak. When it comes to the mental side, I would go with either Roger or Novak. It's and also Rafa. It's tough to spread those three guys. They are so tough mentally, all of them. And if you see how many things they have going on outside the court as well, it's crazy how they can stay focused and how they can win so many slams for so many years, and they have been dominating for so many years. They almost never have a bad week. That's, for me, it's incredible. So it's tough to separate those guys. Volley, yeah. I would say. So I'd probably say Pat Rafter. During my era, I think no one in the in the top. Playing right now has the volley that he had moving around the court and was very tough to pass him, both lobbing him and passing him. It was incredible when he won his US Open. I played against him 1 year when he won the US Open, and he was just all over the net, all the time. So it was really tough. There you go.
I thought you were going to say Edberg.
That's
what I was saying. As is your
idol. He's my number two for sure. But he was a little bit before my era, so I played against Pat and I coached against Pat, and he was just amazing.
Great.
Interesting. And of course, there's one question, John, you haven't asked, which we always ask, which is a different sport. Who's your football team?
I'm a big sports fan in general, but I don't really have a favorite football team. I used to watch Arsenal when Freddie Ljungberg was playing there a couple of years ago. He was a mate of mine, so used to go and fly over to London to watch him play sometimes. But now I don't have a really favorite team. I follow ice hockey a lot, NHL, and that's it.
And John supports a team. I don't know if you know, but if you're not really into football, John, do you want to reveal the team that you support?
Well, of course, the famous Wolverhampton Wanderers. Of course, Magnus knows them. Of course, the Wolves. Of course, he knows them.
Of course I do.
Of course he does. Magnus, one last question here. What do you make of the Australian Open going ahead with all this stuff going on? I mean, can you put it into perspective how difficult it is for... with this 19 hours in the rooms and some of them even 2 weeks, 24 hours in the room. I mean, how on earth are they going to play a slam in those conditions? It's mind-boggling. In that heat, it's mind-boggling, isn't it?
Yeah, it's going to be, it's of course very difficult, and it's not the same for everyone, which makes it a little bit unfair, I think. But it's first of all, I think it's incredible that Tennis Australia, the ATP Tour, has ITF has put together this tournament in this pandemic. I think first of all, it's you have to put a lot of credit to everyone involved, and I see a lot of pictures. They have bikes in the hotel rooms, and they're really making an effort to try to get the players to prepare as good as possible during this tough times. But yeah, I spoke to Elias Ymer a couple of days ago, and he was in his room and, trying to stay fit and not being able to hit. Of course, it's not the ideal situation, but I think all the players are really happy to that the tournament first of all can take place. You know, then yeah. You know, preparation is you know second thing, but of course I cannot imagine how it must be for everyone there involved, the players, coaches, you know, everyone staying there. So yeah, I'm excited to see how it's going to be. I hope that no one will get like a really serious injury, because if you know if you stay in a hotel room for two weeks and then you have to go out and in that heat and play best of five sets, you know, it's not the best preparation for the body. So yeah. Just hope that no one gets you know really injured. But yeah, I'm just think that the players are happy to be there and starting to compete soon again.
Absolutely.
Well, listen, I know that John's got a dash, and Magnus, I'm sure you're very busy. We kind of got our times mixed up, so I apologise. It's been great talking to you, Magnus. I've got so much respect for you, as I know John has. Amazing player, amazing coach. And we've got to see you back out there on the tour soon. I don't want to push you out there, particularly now, obviously. It's probably the best time for you to be at home, but... You know, we want to see you back out there coaching these players, because you do a damn good job, and we're thrilled to have had you here on the podcast, Magnus. Genuinely,
thank you.
Yeah, thanks, mate.
Appreciate it. It was nice to talk to you both, Keith and John. Stay safe, and see you soon.
Yeah, take care.
Hope to see you soon, Magnus. Keep safe, and be well. We'll speak soon. Take care, my friend. All the best.
Bye bye.
Magnus Norman there, John. What a great guy. Unbelievable career. What an amazing. Well, what can you say? An amazing tennis career from playing to coaching. You talked about Robin when he was on, saying there's only three men above you. You said the same to Henman. Well, there was only one man above him. He was number two in the world. And look what he's done as a coach. It's unbelievable, no?
Yeah, he has an amazing record. And I love the way that he plans things. And you can just see he's very methodical. And he has that way about him that gets into people's heads, but without being over the top. And I always thought that he'd be a very calming influence. I just wonder, you know, if he comes back in a couple of years, which I hope he will, he just will have to make sure he picks his charge very well, because I think even since he stopped, the patience of people is just so much worse than it was. It seems to be these days, the cycle of coaches, you know, going in and out of a revolving door seems to be so quickly, because they don't see the master plan. They're so eager for instant success. And Magnus Norman is someone that he's in there for the long run. He prepares his players unbelievably well. And look at his record. But if I was going to sign up with him now with a plan, I would say, give him time. Give him time. He will succeed, whoever he's with. He's got that kind of a record. And what a great guy to have around, and knows his stuff, and just a nice man.
It's incredible, his record. I mean, look, we could carry on talking this, and I know you got to run, but what an amazing record! I mean, he got Söderling to two French Open finals. He was coaching Söderling, I think, when he beat Nadal at the French Open. Who does that apart from Novak?
Exactly.
His record is just phenomenal. Yeah. And he's a nice guy to boot. I'm sure he'll produce some champions at his academy. Good to grow.
Oh, yeah.
John, always good to speak to you. Sorry if I was trying to hurry things up there.
No.
And we'll do it all again next week, my friend. And
we will.
Have
Take
a good
care.
Day, yeah?
Take care. Bye-bye.
Please remember to press that subscribe button and share with all your friends. You can also follow us on Twitter, RNR_tennis. And, of course, on Instagram, rock'n'roll_tennis. And please, leave us a review. We'd love to hear your comments. We will, of course, see you next week, as always. Thanks so much again.